those of us who are questioning narratives and those of us who are curious and wanting to bring that nuance and that dialogue back, that's where that compassion piece comes in. Just because somebody decided to get the vaccine, we have no, it's so much more nuanced than just you're on one side or the other. Something that I've personally witnessed in people who've chosen not to get vaccinated, and many of them, is they're not showing the grace to the other side that they wish to be shown themselves. And so I think that something that we can remember is that each of us has come to our own personal decision based on so many countless different factors.
You know, I had a conversation with a friend who's very much pro-narrative right now, but he always has, there is open dialogue between us. So, you know, he looks at it to me and says that he was vaccinated for me, for his grandparents, and for the community. And I told him, I'm not doing it. Maybe I would like to, but I'm choosing to say no also for you and for your kids. So they may have the same option. Mm-hmm.
Do you get the feeling that we are living through something that will be written about for hundreds of years?
Unquestionably. And I join you in the, let's say, the spiritual overview of the whole thing. It's quite purposeful in a larger sense, but a topic for another time, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it's good to be open, isn't it? I mean, even if we don't have all the answers, realizing that you don't have all the answers and that you're on the lookout for them is that puts us, I think, way ahead of the curve in society right now.
Today's guest is Dr. Julie Panessi. She's got a little quip here, asking questions, challenging the narrative, and other ways to get canceled in 2021. She has a PhD in philosophy from 2008 from the University of Western Ontario, one of the largest universities in Canada. And she specializes in ethics and ancient philosophy. This is another big handle. She also has a master's in philosophy with collaborative specialization in bioethics from the University of Toronto. And, you know, she's not a doctor, healthcare provider, scientist, or anything like that. But what that bioethics is about is stepping back and taking a bigger picture about the right and wrong of how health policies and health procedures are rolling out. So that's pretty cool. And she also has a diploma in ethics from the Kennedy Institute of Ethics at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. So all of her 20 years of teaching at universities in Canada and the U.S., all that changed in the fall of 2021, when, as many of us know now, she saw her academic career fall apart after refusing to comply with this Canadian university's vaccine mandate that, ironically, is unethical. So she was fired middle of September, 2021. And this video that went viral was directed to her first year ethics students, Ethics 101. And it was a short lesson on the universally accepted ethics of coercing people into medical procedures. She'd already been involved in media. Like, it wasn't like she went from being a university professor out of sight and then suddenly being in the media. I mean, it was a big change to leave academia, but she'd already been involved with COVID Care Alliance as the chair of the Ethics and Law Committee. And she'd been volunteering with them for months and doing a lot of media through them. And then in early November of 2021, the Democracy Fund, one of the largest civil liberties organizations in Canada, offered Dr. Panessi the position of the Pandemic Ethics Scholar. So now she's in a more formal role with resources through the Democracy Fund, and her focus is on educating the public on civil liberties through speeches and interviews. So she's been interviewed and conducting interviews. And then she released her book. It's a pretty short one because she wanted to get it out in December. My Choice, The Ethical Case Against COVID-19 Vaccine Mandates. With passion and intelligence, Dr. Panessi charts her account of the dramatic change of her career direction and its ongoing aftermath. However, her story travels beyond the personal by examining our pandemic responses, philosophical dimensions, and ethics. For anyone who feels alone while persevering and also preserving personal choice and freedom, Dr. Julie Panessi's book offers compassionate guidance and encouragement on how to move forward and share your voice. You can go through the democracyfund.ca website or mychoicebook.ca. Hi, Julie. Thank you. Thank you for coming. We are all very excited to be here.
Oh, well, that's so sweet. Where are you all physically in the world?
A lot of different places. We've got some Ontario, British Columbia, Spain, Vancouver.
My goodness, you're not kidding.
No, people are coming in from a lot of different time zones.
Wow, my goodness. Well, it's 11:30 a.m. where I am, so.
Yeah, we're just coming up to it here. Just expecting a couple more people, and then we'll lock the room so that we can stay focused for half an hour. You have a hard stop at high noon, right?
I do, and that's because I have a 20-month-old who is the least patient person in my life. So.
Oh, my goodness.
She doesn't understand Zoom time limits and things like that.
Well, you have an older daughter?
She's our only one. So.
I heard you say something about having a daughter that's not school age. So I thought she was like older, out of school. I didn't realize.
No. We're yet to go. Well, we're probably never going through all of that, to be quite honest with you, given the situations these days. I see my book up on your shelf. My goodness. That was pretty.
That was Val's idea. Get her book up there.
And you have horses. I come from a long line of, my grandfather was a horse breeder and trainer, and my mother is a horse lover and Welsh pony owner. And so I have a long.
Wow, that's so awesome. That's amazing, you know, because I was going to actually use an example, and I can do that right now because we still have a minute before I lock the room. We officially begin. I've done a lot of work with equus wisdom, you know, where you do a lot of just walking with horses, just being with horses. And I was doing this exercise, like a boundary exercise, walking with the horse, holding the lead. And the idea was that when I wanted to stop, I would stop and the horse would stop.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And so I did that and the horse like started to walk a little bit more. And so what I was to do was to be firm and say, stop here. This is where we stop.
Yeah, I've worked with trainers like that, very gentle, sort of a non-physical approach to training. We could talk about that for a long time, but it's very, very interesting. And the reason we got into that is because my mom has stallions and, you know, you learn pretty quickly that training has to be a matter of respect because there's no physical domination. They're so big and powerful. It has to be a learned relationship building kind of thing.
Exactly.
That's how we need to relate to one another. We're better with the horses, or the horses are better at it than we are. So,
well, they have a lot to teach us, that's for sure. And I appreciated that exercise very much. It gave me a sense of where I'm letting boundaries slip and where I'm saying I'm being fudgy with the line. And I think we're seeing that now going forward is just how the line is really being changed so often, so much. And I'm going to lock the room. Hi, Julie. Thanks so much for joining us. We've all been aware of you for a few months now since your video went viral. I mean, this is an epic moment we're in right now because it's been 2 years, right?
Well, we're into the third calendar year, aren't we now?
Well, we're into the third calendar year and you have your little dog, which I
yes, he's the second least patient person in my life.
You have your hands full for sure. And so philosophy applied, you know, you're applying philosophy and ethics from your education to what's going on. And I mean, I think of lockdowns and solitary confinement. I always thought those were for prisoners and masks were for slaves and cult people, not children and healthy people. So what the heck, how do you see what's going on? I mean, it's changing daily. It's getting crazier by the minute and we still have to be positive. So where do you see us, where we've come from, where we're going?
So many interesting things there. You know, when I was in academia, and I write about this in the book a little bit, I felt like there were a lot of things I liked about it, but it also felt a little bit disingenuous, you know, talking about probably ethics would be the class I taught most out of all the classes. And there was always something a little bit fake, or you always had a bit of an imposter syndrome when you were doing it, not because I thought there was another expert who could do it better, but because it always felt like doing ethics in the classroom and starting from, this is how ethics textbooks pretty much all do it, start from thought experiments and then move to commentary about those thought experiments as though we can learn something that we can apply to our real lives, our practical lives, right? And the thing that's in common between all thought experiments is that it's almost impossible for them to happen in real life, because the reason for having a thought experiment is you're making something so extreme or so hyperbolic that it wouldn't be possible for it to happen. And you're doing that to sort of push on our intuitions about what we think is right. So one of the really famous ones that you guys might have heard of is the trolley experiment. And it's sort of meant to push on our intuitions about whether what matters is creating the most good for the greatest number of people or individual rights. That's kind of what's pitted against each other. And then in, you know, I've taken a number of medical ethics classes and I've taught them, and you do the same kind of thing. You talk about these extreme examples. Even in the moment when I was doing academic ethics, I realized there's a bit of a disconnect here between the examples we talk about and what we think is worth discussing in the context of learning about ethics, and then what it's like to live as a person trying to be moral. I wrote my thesis on Aristotle's ethics, actually. So Aristotle was a 4th century BC Greek philosopher, and he wrote extensively about how morality has to be lived. You know, it's not the kind of thing you can learn in a classroom like mathematics or history. Mm-hmm. You have to practice it. You have to try. You have to engage in activities to see how they go, see how they turn out, see how you feel about them. And then there's kind of a feedback system into your character. But anyway, it has to be tried. It has to be practiced. And my goodness, talk about, what is the saying, from the frying pan into the flames or something, right? That saying. Mm-hmm. And that's so much what we have now. And one of the crazy things about that video I did going viral is that never should have happened. That video and what I said there never should have caught the attention of the world, because what I did was exercising the choice that 40 years of bioethics sort of literature in North America, at least, if not in sort of the Western world, and so much of jurisprudence has been built up to support, which is this idea of free, informed, autonomous medical choice. And it's almost like collectively we have got a kind of amnesia. If you go out your front door and shout autonomy or free choice or something, people will look at you like, what are these odd words? Is that a foreign language or something? You know? And it's like in any sort of legal context, political context, journalism, social media now, people on the kind of, I hate to kind of draw these battle lines, but on the anti-narrative side, use these words and throw them across the wall, right? People on the other side are like, what is this crazy thing of which you speak? I have never heard of these concepts, you know? So it's a very, I mean, you allude to this in your comments, but it's such a surreal time. There's such a disconnect from where we've come from, where we were at 3 years ago, and what the world is looking like now and what the rules are now.
You talk about applying in real life. I remember this early on, being told that wearing a mask is virtuous. And, what's the expert saying that, skating, that could be virtuous, but, you know, contact sport might not be. And I remember at the time, this is like almost 2 years ago, and just going, you got to be kidding me.
What's so interesting about that, the word virtue, our word virtue, comes from the Greek arete, which also means excellence. And that word arete got connected sort of in the moral context with the ancient Greek philosophers like Aristotle. So they were bringing into the notion of morality or ethics this idea of excellence, and then in the context of human flourishing. So the idea there, right, is that what it is to be moral is to be flourishing. It's to be excellent as a human being. It's to be doing what it is we're good at as humans, which is, you know, exercising our rationality in a practical context and doing that excellently. Well, if we want to say now that wearing a mask is virtuous, and if virtue has to do with excellence and flourishing, then in what sense is wearing a mask helping us to flourish? We're not flourishing as a people. We're a miserable, disconnected from their families. They're fighting with their families. We're insecure. We are led to believe that we can't think for ourselves, that we no longer have that skill, that we no longer have that right. we are told to hate one another and not moral, not democratic in my view. And I think we're seeing the psychological, social, economic, downstream harms of all of those things. See, you can tell I get irate about this topic quickly. You know, it's a very doing ourselves great harm, I think.
Yeah, I'd like to just put a hand up for someone who is not totally miserable. Like I'm having a lot of joy in a lot of days. So I feel like that needs to be said. Surely the people who have gone with the program are noticing that they're not getting many perks. They still have to lock down. They might be able to travel, but they have to go through so much rigor with that and danger potentially with the pilots being compromised as well.
Yeah.
So I just wonder why people who've gone with the program aren't saying something or, you know, questioning it more. Or is it maybe just because everybody is getting nervous about even speaking up? I mean, is that part of what's going on?
Well, I think it's a really interesting question, really interesting psychological question. I think we are noticing some shifts, actually. I just heard, someone just sent me a story this morning about someone who just went to get her third booster and was starting to ask questions about this, you know, and it had been quite adamantly in defense of cooperative vaccination prior to that, and sort of thought, well, hold on a minute here. What is this slide from the third to the fourth? It's very interesting to me, you know, why I was just saying to my good friend, you know, why are we seeing that question now and not after the first or not after the second? I'm not sure. I mean, we certainly did see a number of people after the second say, well, hold on, you told me this was a two-dose thing.
Yeah.
And I'd get my freedoms back and I'm not. So I think there are a lot of people who are, they're having some self-doubt. They're having some trust issues with our officials. There's some shifting going on in personal relationships, I think. But you're right. There are a number of people who are still hard towing the line. My experience has been that that's not because, or necessarily because they believe the evidence that's being shown to them, but because they will believe and do whatever authorities tell them. I'm writing a weekly column now for a publication in the States. And the column I wrote this week was on experts, public health officials, and why we consider them to be experts and what that means and what some of the ethical harms are involved with that. And I think we do have this era of, we could call it credentialism or expertiseism. And the problem with that, in my view, is that coupled with it is this outsourcing of our thinking to whoever we consider the experts to be. Mm-hmm. And experts, I think this has been shown historically to be what we're most successful when we take their advice and it makes sense to take, you know, I mean, if you have a heart issue, it makes sense to go to your cardiologist and say, what do you think about this? And not to go to your mechanic, right?
Yeah.
But I don't think it's also right as a patient to go to your cardiologist and just unreflectively accept all of the information. I mean, if that was the case, there would be no room for second opinions, and people very often like to go and get second opinions. So I think we're seeing like a voluntary surrendering of one's right to think for oneself and gather information and think on it for a while and then make a decision that you're willing to stand by, but also a decision you're willing to revise if new evidence comes your way. And then on the other side, we're being kind of trained and primed and nudged by our government and our governing medical bodies, you know, to do that.
And of course, we have a prime minister who's really being very divisive,
to say the least.
Yeah, that's being kind. So the thing is that as more people are coming around, and I think the tipping point is going to be the people who've gone with the program who are now seeing that we've been advocating for all of our rights. We haven't been selfish here. You know, some people are wondering, as people are more open to conversation, wanting to have a bit of an elevator pitch, because there's so much information to somebody who's just sort of opening up to this, you know, where would you start? You don't want to overwhelm them. And at the same time, you also just want some simple action steps. I heard you suggest to be a better listener.
Mm-hmm. Working on the book, and I think I woke up in the night thinking about this, that I never see conversations between two people where the person who isn't speaking isn't just waiting to reply. Sorry about the double negative there, right? But you can imagine this situation where you're talking with someone and they're kind of going, la, 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 are you done talking yet? Because I have my point I want to make. And that's not really, conversation needs to be more, what's the right word? You know, more organic and more integrative than that. And the thing about listening, right, is that if you're really listening to the other person, that's an indication that you think it's possible the other person could have something of value to offer you. The problem these days, it's tough to put yourself in that position if you don't know the other person has that kind of humility as well, or that kind of respect as well, because you're just going to be eaten alive if you do that. And I guess my advice to people, I mean, a lot of people come to me and they ask me, how do I talk to my husband about this? How do I talk to my children? How do I talk to my mother? And, you know, these sorts of things. And I guess this is kind of a tough love line, but I really do think there are only some people with whom you can have that kind of productive conversation, that you can't create it in another person if the seeds of it aren't there. Mm-hmm. And there are some, I think, warning signs that you can look for and pick up on to sort of test the waters to see, is this the kind of person with whom I can have the deepest, most vulnerable kind of conversation? So one question I think you can ask yourself is there any evidence I could present to this person that would make him or her change their mind on this position? And if the answer is no, there isn't any point in going further.
Well, this is it. I mean, I have a friend who's been through the medical system extensively and credits it with saving his life. And so I thought, oh, this was early on. I thought, I'll just send a whole bunch of links, you know, with experts, you know, with really high credentialed people, and it didn't make a dent, you know.
Yeah.
I think you're right. You really have to customize your approach with each person, really.
One of the most interesting people I know on this topic who has made the biggest shift across the, you know, the barricade, so to speak, is a professor friend. And a year plus, maybe a year and a half ago now, he was quite adamantly pro-narrative, very bright guy, full professor, I think, you know, at one of Canada's biggest universities. And he completely switched to the other side. And he's very sensitive and very, you know, he questions the narrative now. And he works with various organizations to defend liberties and things like that. And it's interesting, is the thing that made the difference for him is that he has a very trusting, deep, respectful relationship with his spouse. And his spouse is the one who, I guess, successfully, with a great deal of wisdom, approached him with questions, and that made a conversion in him. But I think when I look at the different stories of success like that, it's all happened within the context of relationships that were very sound to begin with, where there was a lot of trust to begin with. So I'm a bit inclined to think that between people who don't know each other very well, or where there are already the seeds of distrust, or where you start out name calling, these ad hominem character attacks, just throwing, you know, anti-vaxxer and all these words back and forth, I don't think you can get there.
Yeah, or putting a tax on people who aren't complying, and suddenly thousands of people are lining up to comply because they're going to be taxed. I mean,
the next extrinsic motivation, right? We talk about intrinsic versus extrinsic motivations, and we've got a lot of extrinsic motivations as it is. I mean, people who are holding out, there's a lot of courage there. You know, you might think they're wrong, or you might think that it's the wrong position, but we're not likely. I mean, if we're already being kept out of, you know, restaurants and gyms, and we're stigmatized and ostracized and can't go to family gatherings, if we're already faced with all of those behavior limiting circumstances, are we going to change our mind when we now have a financial penalty? I mean, probably some people will, because they won't be able to cope with the financial burden. And that's just another example of how the people who are already marginalized in society have fewer moral choices, you know, are more heavily impacted by harms that come from other people. We've seen this in the past with racial minorities, and we're just doing it again in a slightly different way.
Exactly. We're just coming up to 10 minutes to the hour already, Julie. Barely scratched my notes here.
That's just because I talk too much.
So. Well, one question that I was asked for you is, given what you know now, like, would you have done anything differently back in August, September, when all this was changing for you? Is there anything looking back that you would have done differently?
Perhaps, given what I know now. But what I know now is a set of things I could not possibly have known then. Mm-hmm. For example, I had a more charitable view of my colleagues at Western and of the free the possibility of free discourse mm-hmm. than the reality was. I had an unrealistic view of that, you know, so I tried to talk and ask questions and negotiate, you know, and it turned out that none of those things were effective. I guess I wish I had mm-hmm. known that, but I couldn't have known it. And in some sense, if I had known it, I would have been much more jaded all along. And I don't know if I want to live like that, you know, so.
Really, we make it up as we go along as best we can. And I think you're still teaching and you're still in a position where you can be making such a difference, you know, in your position with the Democracy Fund and the COVID Care Alliance of Canada. So it's fantastic what you're doing. I mean, I'm seeing a lot of your interviews that you're doing with people and also being interviewed. And it's a real honor to have you on Living on Purpose. Does anybody have a question? And I can see you all now. Oh, Farron.
Hi.
Hi.
I don't have a question, but I just wanted to express my endless gratitude for your bravery and your ability to so eloquently put to words what so many of us were feeling, especially at the time that the video came out. And I'm sure you have heard this in every part of your journey, but I just wanted to let you know that you are inspiring many, many, many people who you probably may never meet, but it's really an honor to be here and listen to your thoughts.
Thank you so much for that. You know, it's funny, people who know me know that I'm a bit out of place in the 21st century. If I could have made a choice for myself, it would have been probably to live in another era. But the one thing that the internet has done for us is it allows us to do things like this. It allows us to communicate with people in other parts of the world. And I can't even tell you, you know, the messages that have come, people from other parts of the world, they pour out their hearts. They're so supportive. Yeah. And one thing a lot of people have said is they're just grateful, not just me, but other people, you know, for putting a big voice to all the little voices. And we all have our skills. We all have our things we're afraid of. It's funny. People often say, aren't you afraid to get up in front of a group of people and speak? And I'm not, but it's much more terrifying to me to go maskless in a store and have a face-to-face confrontation. And I know a lot of other people who are much more brave in that respect. So we all kind of have to do what we can do, right? And just, yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Ev.
Thanks so much, Lynn. And thank you, Julie, for being with us today. Julie, when you said that when you did that piece that went viral, that it was not supposed to go viral, like, did you mean that you had no idea that it was going to be as big as it was? And was it a little bit overwhelming? Like, did you get a lot of pushback at that time as well? To share with you that I sent that piece to a professor of mine who woke me in 2001. And I sent that video to him because I see him as somebody who is awake, and got basically shut down, saying that he was the Leopold, what's the good of all should be the good, what you said earlier on. And so it was very interesting because he said he would just distance himself from anybody who was not, whether it was faculty or students, and that if you weren't playing for the good of all, then it's not for the good of all.
Yeah, so. You know, it's so a lot of interesting things there. So to your first question, no, we had no idea. We made the video through the CCCA, and we did it because we were trying to publish all of this really balanced, rigorous scientific stuff, and it wasn't getting anywhere. It wasn't getting any traction. So we thought, well, why don't we try to do a video and we'll release, maybe that'll, you know, and of course it did, but we had no idea. I mean, and it was a matter of hours. The mainstream media guys started calling, and there was just influx of people, emails from all over the world. And I think it's had over 1.5 million views. I mean, it's astounding. And we could never, I mean, if I knew what the recipe was, I'd be doing it again because it's so important to reach people. But no, I had no idea. But what I really meant there is that people find it so shocking, I think, well, someone was willing to stand up for her medical rights, as though that's so crazy, so anomalous, and it shouldn't be. The kind of country I think we've built, I think, maybe I'm wrong about this, but that we've built, that we've worked so hard to build, I thought was supposed to be the place that protected, and not only protected, but supported exactly that. So I would have expected people to watch that video and think, oh, she exercised her medical choice. Good for her. Moving on. You know, and to the professor who says, well, I'm not willing to talk to anyone who doesn't think that the collective good is the best. Well, two odd things about that. One is, that's a sort of utilitarian collectivist view, and that's not been the only acceptable view in academia for a long time. There are competing views about that. And in fact, I think it's actually been the least common view, right? So a focus on, this comes out of the deontological tradition, Immanuel Kant, but a focus on individual rights. I mean, that's what got the pro-choice movement going. You know, so it's not been a for the collective good kind of thing. And then secondly, what bothers me even more about that is, really, professor, you're not willing to talk to, I mean, if you're not willing to, then who in society is willing to have this cancel culture stuff? If we can't address that and fix it moving forward, I think we're just doomed, you know?
I just want to try to get a couple more questions in here. Thank you for that, Christina.
Hi, thanks so much, Julie, for all your beautiful, powerful energy that you've eluded to the world. I want to just start by saying that I studied the Mayan calendar for many years, and there's these levels in the pyramids all around the world where the top level of the pyramid is, it's written in there that there'll be a time that we're in now where power gives way to ethics. That's exactly how it's labeled, even where, and what we're seeing is the extreme of power over domination, oil, everything related to power, the abuse of power, media power, authoritarian power. And at the same time, on the flip side of that is this, where people are actually questioning their own value system and their own ethics. And what's rising out of this is a new paradigm based on ethics. And it's just interesting that you brought it to the attention of so many of us. So do you feel that in a way that this is a catalyst to awakening a new level of consciousness?
So interesting. I don't know about the Mayan culture or architecture very much, you know, so that's really interesting to me. But as you're talking, it reminds me a lot of what people are telling me about this book. Is it The Fourth Turn or The Fourth Turning or something? I don't know very much about it, but I think the idea there is that a society kind of moves through different phases every decade or two or something like that. And I think that what you're suggesting is very plausible. In academia, we talk a lot about how we've kind of gone through this postmodern era, and postmodernism is, whatever you want to say about it, it's a bit disconcerting because it leaves you in a state of being a bit uncomfortable because there's no objective truth anymore. You know, it's sort of an anything goes nihilistic feeling. And my own view is that we're in a bit of a free fall from that, where so many of us, we're just not really sure what we're supposed to think anymore or who we are or what our purpose in life is. You know, you may know the ancient Greek myth of Sisyphus, and the philosopher Camus wrote about Sisyphus, and Sisyphus was punished by the gods and he had to keep rolling the same boulder up the hill every day, only to have it roll back down again. And supposed to be kind of a metaphor for the purposelessness of life, right? And Camus' lesson from that is that, what are you supposed to do in the face of that kind of emptiness and purposelessness? Well, you just have to embrace choice and move forward anyway. But yeah, I think the comments you make about power are very interesting. I think we're also seeing the kind of hate speech we see from our politicians, just blatant, you know, and I think between people on social media or within relationships, that's a kind of power play move, right? It's, if I call you a name loudly enough, often enough, and it's mean enough, you will back down and I don't have to do anything more than that. I don't have to rely. Like, name calling is like the lowest rung of rhetoric, right? It's like inhuman. This is not something mature adults should be doing with one another, in my view, right? But I think the fact that we're there, there's probably a sign that we think we can rest on like a brute sort of force to deal with people that's totally outside morality or without morality or something. And maybe we're starting to see an emptiness to that, as you're suggesting. We're kind of wondering, well, where's that leaving us? Well, I don't have a good relationship with my family anymore. I feel empty. I can't trust my government. I don't have a country. What's democracy? Like, you know, we're kind of left in this identity crisis, sort of free fall. And what emerges out of that? Well, maybe, as you say, a new kind of paradigm, a new ethical paradigm. And one of the things about ethics, regardless of what your particular view is, there's this common thread, this idea that so much of the world is beyond our control, and all we can do is rely on our own reasoning powers. All we can do is control what we can control, and the rest of it we can't, right? And make our lives what we can, and find purpose for ourselves, and find happiness and contentment in that. So very interesting. Thank you for that. One more. I see
there's all right. Yeah.
We can do one more.
Okay, Len, yes.
Hi, Julie.
Hi.
A simple question in statement, but maybe not in response.
They're never simple questions in philosophy. You probably know.
Have you yourself had thoughts about what's driving this aberrant behavior, not just in our government, but governments around the world?
Most moments of every day. Really good question. You know, the thing that horrifies me on a daily basis is not that a government could misuse or abuse its power. I mean, that happens time and time again. It may be inevitable. I mean, I think humans we're imperfect in a number of ways. And one of the ways in which we're imperfect is not to handle power very well, right? So it doesn't surprise me that governments would be capable of abuses of power. What does surprise me and horrify me on a daily basis is that the majority of us are cheering them on, or the loudest majority are cheering them on. I never thought we would see that in our country, you know? So I think there's a question there about how did that come to be? That doesn't just emerge ex nihilo out of nothing, you know, in one year. Yeah. You know, and I've talked with a lot of really bright, historically, psychologically sensitive people about how this comes to be. And I've said earlier that a lot of people feel very miserable. Well, you know, teaching, not that I do this anymore, but the group of people I taught who are sort of 18 to 22, they are a miserable bunch. Let me tell you, they are not happy to be at university. They don't feel privileged. They don't feel like their whole lives are in front of them. One of them said to me once that they don't think anyone under 40 believes that anything good can ever happen again. You know, and someone said to me something interesting the other day about Jordan Peterson. I don't know what you guys think about him, but someone tried to explain his popularity. And the theory was that he's seen as a father figure to so many people who didn't have a father. Mm. You know, and I think there is a sense in which that group of young people just have not had a lot of structure and a lot of purpose and a lot of meaning in their lives. And so they're kind of ripe for someone to take leadership and say, I'll tell you what to do. I'm the prime minister and I'll tell you, go out and hate people. And they're kind of like, yeah, okay, there's a thing. Someone's giving leadership, you know? So I think there might be something there. I also think, and you know, I'm happy to be quite honest about this. I'm a person of faith, and I think we have a lot less of that in society these days. And it doesn't have to be like a particular religion, but, you know, I think just having a kind of faith or a feeling that there's a bigger purpose than yourself, whatever that is, really gives your life a kind of stabilizing power, such that when things happen or come at you or people are telling you things, you can always evaluate that incoming data in relation to this guiding principle in your life, whatever it is. And so I think it's not surprising that a loss of the ability to weigh data and then accept some and reject some is probably linked to this overarching loss of faith or purpose or meaning or whatever it is, you know? So there's lots of theories about what's going on geopolitically. My own feeling, and I'm not an expert in that area by any means, but I do think that a rational person looking at the evidence, looking at what's going on globally, it's hard not to think that there isn't a coordinated effort of some kind, because it's not like, you know, I mean, at times past, goodness, I mean, what resolved? I'm not a historian of world wars by any means, but one of the things surely that resolved the Second World War and the Holocaust was that there were allied forces, you know, people in other countries who believed different things from what was going on in Germany, for example. Yeah. And we don't really have that kind of diversity among countries right now, right? We kind of have a group think globally, and that's really scary, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know if that answers. It's a hard question. It's the question, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. Thanks for what you said about it. There's lots more going on than meets the eye, that's for sure.
I think so. And I don't think we're going to know or understand it until we have the fullness of time, as they say, you know, this will be, but do you get the feeling that we are living through something that will be written about for hundreds of years?
Unquestionably. And I join you in the spiritual overview of the whole thing. It's quite purposeful in a larger sense, but a topic for another time, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it's good to be open, isn't it? I mean, even if we don't have all the answers, realizing that you don't have all the answers and that you're on the lookout for them puts us, I think, way ahead of the curve in society right now. So anyway, I thank you all so much. And I'd love to chat with you again sometime.
Oh, that would be great. We will definitely have you back. Thank you so much, Julie. I really appreciate
it. Bye, everyone. Of course. Okay. Take care.
Thank you.
The theory of the early adopters, the middle adopters, and late adopters. You know about that? Yeah.
Tell me more about that.
Oh, okay. Well, in doing organizational change, they identified three different groups. If you want to make a change in an organization, you find the people who are early adopters. They'll go with it right away, and you get them on board. The early adopters will bring on the middle adopters. That's the 40% group. And then the late group, the late adopters, there's still some people in there who will go along, and the rest will be let go. They'll be fired because they won't be part of the culture. They won't fit into the culture. That's just a generalization, but that's been around for many decades. I'm thinking with Julie, she's the pandemic scholar.
The pandemic ethics scholar.
That's very significant for humanity moving forward as a more high-profile voice with credibility, not only as a historian, but as a promoter of this and putting it forward, that could be very good. So, I mean, that would be more of a focus in these times.
Dr. Julie Panessi's book offers compassionate guidance and encouragement on how to move forward and share your voice. And you can go through the democracyfund.ca website or mychoicebook.ca.